The first thing which intrigues me is the response of Yosef, which I can break down into two different issues. One is the response of Yosef initially, and two is the response of Yosef ongoing throughout this entire episode. I want to speak mainly today about the initial response, and then Bli Neder next week we'll talk about... We have class next week? They make you learn on Hanukkah? Yeah. Is it suv zeh? Is it basa?
Just until 4.
Just until 4. Mazeh is early. Okay. So the... the initial response and then the ongoing response. Yosef is somebody, and again, based on everything we see about him, he's somebody who has a great ability of what we can call, what's called in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, Haro'a et Hanolad. He sees how things are going to come out. It's not just his ability of interpreting dreams, because if we look carefully at his at the dream interpretation of Paro, it wasn't just that he said, okay, this is what's going to happen, because if this is what's going to happen, then all he would have had to say was, there's going to be 7 good years and 7 bad years, and that would have been the end of the end of it. It wasn't just that. Yosef was unable to create a long-term economic policy and strategy for an empire, and one which proved to be actually, 100% correct. Yosef stands in front of Paro at the age of 30, and he dies at the age of 110, which means that he rules effectively for 80 years. But I don't know if somebody else, who you can, think at the top of your head in Tanakh, somebody who has leadership for that long, for successful leadership for that kind of time, which, by the way, is also why it's relatively preposterous when we hear later on of a new king who doesn't know who Yosef is. What do you mean, don't know who Yosef is? I mean, Yosef is the one who created the financial success of this place. Unless, of course, the new king later on comes not from the same lineage and not from the same kingdom and is really a hostile takeover, which there are some sources to suggest that there's a whole new leadership, again, not from Egypt at all. There may have been intrigue there. But nonetheless, Yosef is somebody who has this incredible ability of seeing things before they happen, seeing things how they're going to develop. I've said a number of times that if you think of all the characters in Tanakh that you probably would not want to play a game of chess against, I think Yosef would be the number one person. Because again, who knows how many moves ahead Yosef sees, and that's part of what happens as here. But that actually creates a question. The question is, this meeting that takes place, and it really is dramatic, so we'll say the dramatic meeting that takes place this week between Yosef and his brothers. Yosef had a lot of time to think about it. This did not come as a surprise that one day Yosef goes to work, he gets up in the morning, he packs off his lunch and he goes off to work, and then lo and behold, he can't believe it, look, his brothers are over there. So that's not what happened. Yosef knew that they would be coming.
How?
Because I said so.
No, but he wasn't a prophet.
Right, but he knew they'd be coming. You ask me. Of course he knew. But what I'm saying, how do I know that he knew?
No, I can understand that he had like a strategy of ruling, but he couldn't know. Maybe he knew there was going to be a...
He knows there's a famine in the whole area. He knows he's the only source for food, and anybody who needs food comes to him. Let me put it this way. There's no way that this came as a shock or a surprise that his brothers are there. And I want to say it the other way around. I think that Yosef knew it, he anticipated it, which really then leads us to another point. And that is, while Yosef was waiting for his brothers to come, did he ever go through the scene in his mind? Did he ever think about exactly what he's going to say? Did he...
Yeah.
That's what I would think. Again, somebody like Yosef, I would think that he knows they're going to come. Again, you don't like my word no, I'm not backing down from it, but I'm exaggerating a little bit. He knows they're going to come. He's thought about what he's going to say. He's played this out in his mind numerous times already. And the question then is, why does he do what he ends up doing? And again, what is this larger plan over here? I mean, from his first dream that all of their wheat, really, is going to bow down to his, he knew that this is going to happen. I mean, again, that's his connection with the dreams. When Paro has the dream, and again, the second part of the dream, because he says it's one dream, when Paro has the dream, and the second dream is about, again, about wheat swallowing up the other wheat, if I'm Yosef, I'm not just interpreting Paro's dream. I realize that Paro's dream now is somehow going to become linked together with my dream, which means this should not be a surprise of Yosef as well, even when Paro gives him the job. Yosef did lay out for him what he should do the next bunch of years, and Paro accepts this, which the coming of Yosef's brothers, as I'm saying, shouldn't be a surprise. Let's read the words, because there is something there which doesn't seem to make all that much sense. V'Yosef hu ha-shalit al ha-aretz, hu ha-mashbir l'chol am ha-aretz, v'yivoh achei Yosef yishtachavu l'opayim aretza. Yosef he's the Lord, he's in charge. I'm sure you all appreciate the word mashbir over here, right? So, wow, look at that, they put the mashbir over here. And his brothers come and they bow down to him. V'yar Yosef et echav v'yakireim. Yosef sees his brothers, he recognizes them. V'yitnaker aleihem. But he makes himself strange to them. V'yitam kashot, and he speaks to them with great anger, or harshly. V'yomer aleihem me'ayin batem, and he says, where have you come from? V'yomer me'eretz Canaan, lish baruch hu. We came from the land of Canaan to get food. Then the Torah seems to repeat itself, and this again is going to be a problem. He recognized them, they didn't recognize him. But they just said that he recognized them. So the commentaries actually have a hard time with this, trying to figure out, you know, what the various recognizing means. Do we need the heat, by the way? Or?
No.
Yes? No? If you start to freeze, you'll tell me. So there are those who claim that the first time he sees them, he sees that they are his brothers, but he doesn't. He sees all 10 of them. Okay, these are his brothers, but then there's this added recognition of saying, "Oh, that's Reuven and that's Shimon and that's Levi. That's the second Yakir." But they don't recognize him. And again, I had this thought that in Yosef's mind, he probably thinks. I'm making all this up, by the way. Hope you forgive me for this. That I would say that when Yosef's brothers come, what's his anticipation? They're going to walk in. They're going to see him in his royal clothing. Because again, Yosef is this kind of character who was always supposed to be king. Remember we said the same thing around a month ago? We said the same thing about Hagar. She was supposed to be queen. She was born to be queen. She's supposed to be queen. She becomes queen. So of course she's queen, which is then creates the tension between her and Sarah. But Yosef is the one who's supposed to be king. Why is he supposed to be king? His father gives him the royal clothing. That's Ketonet Pasim. He's supposed to be king. He's supposed to be ruler. Which means all that's happened now is that they have finally recognized Yosef for who he is. And by the way, that is the great irony in Yosef's life. And I think I've said this before and we'll say it again. I'll probably say it again today. The great irony of Yosef's life is that every single person who meets him along the way recognizes his greatness and puts him in charge. And the only ones who don't recognize it are his own brothers. Right? He gets the house of Potiphar, he's in charge. He gets the prison, he's in charge. He meets Paro, he's in charge. Again, it happens every single time. So Yosef, and again, he must have been unbelievably extraordinary in terms of his wisdom, his insight, his charisma, his ability to see, to analyze, whatever. And I think it's very difficult for us to try to find a modern day comparison to Yosef was. Again, all that we can say is what we see in front of us. Everybody sees it, understands it, and loves him for this, and puts him in charge because of this. The first one who did was his father. Right? As we noted, it doesn't say V'Yaakov Ahavet Yosef, it says V'Yisrael Ahavet Yosef. It's a sense of on a national level, as a leader, Yosef. Yosef is so good that the brothers, if they realized his greatness, never would have sold him, simply because two parts. One, a guy like this you want on your side. And two, a guy like this you don't want on anybody else's side. I mean, that's how good Yosef is. And as I said, the brothers are the only ones who are completely blind to it. But I think in Yosef's mind, when the brothers walk into the palace, and they bow down to him, they see him and they bow down to him, I think in Yosef's mind, he recognizes them, guess he figured this is part of his fantasy, right? We all are allowed to live with our fantasies in our minds. What's his fantasy? His fantasy is, again, let's just play it through now.
That they'll recognize him as a king.
That they'll recognize him and say, oh, that's Yosef. Yosef really is king. Which means, what's Yosef's fantasy all these years as he's waiting for his brothers to come? They're going to walk in, bow down, and say, okay, Yosef. Manasseh. Tzadakta. Tzichaktota. What are you going to say? That's it. I mean, so they come and they bow down, and Yosef doesn't say anything because what's he waiting for?
But they're still separating. They see a king.
Exactly. So they come in, they all bow down. So again, I'm just trying to get into Yosef's head. What's Yosef's fantasy? His fantasy is the brothers walk in, he sees them, he recognizes them, they see him, and they recognize him, they bow down to him, and he doesn't have to say anything. But what should they say?
I don't think that's his fantasy. I think that's just what he expects.
That's why it's fantasy. I call it a fantasy. You don't want to call it a fantasy? You have a better word?
I don't feel like that's what he wants, right?
It's the.
I'm saying that he's like searching for kavod.
I understand it, but I'm saying as he plays this out in his mind before it happens,
okay.
Right? When he's thinking about it, right. Weeks before, a year before, he's had 9 years to think about this moment,
right?
At least over the last 9 years, he knows this moment is coming. He knows there's going to be a famine in the whole land. He knows his brothers are coming. He knows they're going to come in and they're going to have to bow down to him. I don't want to put this and make Yosef into an egoist or egotist or whatever, but I'm saying that that's the way that things are, is that anybody who comes in and wants food is going to have to bow down because he really is in charge. The commentaries have a difference of opinion on what the word avrech means. Avrech. So the famous Rashi is av bechokhma, right? Rach b'shanim. But it's not the only thing Rashi says. Rashi also suggests that avrech, the pshat is, that it means everybody has to bow down to him, from the word berech.
Avrech means...
It's you. It says, Paro calls him Avrech. It wasn't that he was learning in Kolo at the time. He was learning Beit Yosef. No. He Rashi understands the Pshat is that he called him Avrech. He called that everybody has to bow down on their knees in front of Yosef. That Yosef, this is his rule. Everybody bows down. So I'm saying, the brothers walk in and they bow down. So we have every reason to believe, because that's what protocol is. You walk in, you see a king, you or somebody who's close to the king. You bow down. So the brothers bow down. So I'm going back again. If you don't like the word fantasy, then you have to replace it and give me a better word. I'm saying, as Yosef plays this through his head, his imagination, any word you use, you're not going to say dreams, you're not going to like dreams, you're not going to like any word I use, so it doesn't make a difference. I'm past that. His fantasy is that the brothers are going to come in and they're going to all bow down to him in recognition that he is Yosef. And then what happens? Again, just how do things play out then? And then what happens? And they say... Okay, Zemet. I'm saying right here, you're right in front of you, right here. They're bowing down. They're coming to him for food, which is exactly what his first dream is. And they say, "Okay, you were right." So, can you imagine the frustration when the brothers actually act like strangers? No. Well, now you could tell me, why do they act like strangers? Because they really don't recognize him. Which, by the way, is itself part of the problem. They don't recognize him. They don't know who he is. They bow down, and Yosef's waiting. By the way, read the words again now, because I think it's a little more interesting now. But Yosef was right. Vayavo Achei Yosef. It's also interesting that they called Achei Yosef over here. Vayavo Achei Yosef v'yishtachavu lo paim arza. So you notice the long silence there? There's silence, by the way. It's what the Chumash doesn't say. That's where the silence is. The silence is they bow down, and what they don't say. Don't you love that when I'm being medayik and what it doesn't say instead of what it does say? I'm sorry. But look, it's jumping out at you. Vayar Yosef etachav vayakirein, and he recognizes them, vayitnaker. And then he makes himself to be a stranger. Why does he make himself to be a stranger? What am I now suggesting? As a response to them making themselves as strangers. Now, why are they keep making themselves as strangers? Because they think he's a stranger. Why do they think he's a stranger? So again, this is the first step. It's going to get worse. But this is the first step, and I've been talking too much already. But why is this a problem right now? Because they cannot imagine that it's Yosef. Wouldn't you expect, when they walk in, look at him, say, damn, that guy looks familiar. I know I've seen that guy before. Right? There's just something familiar about him. There's something over here. But nothing. Not a flicker of recognition, not a moment of saying anything. Instead, they act as if they're complete strangers. Why? It's not just that it's out of context. It's not just that. And by the way, I do have to ask another question. And this is a very serious question. If the brothers knew that Yosef was sold down to Egypt, if you knew that you have a long-lost brother who ends up in another city, and you come to that city, would you be looking at each person's face and saying, hold it, is that him, is that him? Would you be looking around for the for that long-lost brother? Right? Have you ever spoken to any people that are family members that were among the Yemenite children that were kidnapped? You know about this, right? The missing Yemenite children?
No.
Or you don't know anything about this? Yes, no, maybe? In the early years of the state, a whole bunch, thousands, I don't know the exact number, of Yemenite children went missing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And there's a woman who I know who cuts my wife's hair, and she says that whenever she goes to a mall, whenever she goes out, she's looking at people's faces, looking for her sister who she hasn't seen in 50 years.
They were all kidnapped.
According to the rumors, you want to be part of the conspiracy, that the Ashkenazi Holocaust survivors took them, the ones that didn't have children, they took them, because the Yemenites don't need so many children, they have too many children anyway.
They also cared about the actual...
Yeah, what?
What's the other...
Is that they died?
Where?
That a whole bunch of people, because that's what they said, they were sick, they died, and...
Well, like, who took them?
They were buried after they died.
But and they never found any of them? Like, how, like, where'd they disappear? Thousands, somebody must have taken them or something. Are you talking about infants?
Young, yeah.
Oh.
I think it makes sense that they weren't looking for them. Because clearly they didn't want to forgive it. They didn't move past the whole incident. Because when you're looking for them, you want to find them. You want to find your longest brother. They have no interest in reconnecting with them. They're not going to look up for them. They stopped up because they were in front of a king. They didn't want to know him because they didn't want the dream to come true. So they kind of even, maybe even put a cover over their eyes.
Everything you're saying could be true, but I'm asking you a different question. I'm asking if you go to a city that you know your long-lost brother is there.
How do you know?
Because they sold him. They sold him down to Egypt. The thing was on its way down
to
Egypt.
Sold
him to Ishmael. It said that was going to Egypt. It said that right there in the text, right away.
Right, yes, so if they would be looking at everyone's face, they'd also be looking at the king's face.
I'm just saying, again, you can argue with me.
It's safe to assume that he's dead. It's how many years later he was sold into slavery?
Twenty-two years later.
Right. What's the likelihood that he's still going to be waltzing around Egypt?
Seven. I'm making that up. I don't know. I don't know what the likelihood is. But my point is, the last time they saw Yosef, he was in a caravan heading down to Egypt. Now they're in Egypt. So again, are they actively looking for Yosef? Are they in passing looking? So again, we have what they're doing, and we have Yosef's fantasy. And that's why I'm going back to fantasy. What's Yosef's fantasy? Yosef's fantasy is, A, at least they would recognize him. But why should they recognize him? Or B, that they're looking for him at least. But A, I'm saying they should recognize him. I'm saying that's a first level of fantasy. First level of fantasy is that they've come to realize their mistake, and they've come to realize that when they replay it in their mind, realize how great really Yosef is. They don't know what's happened in the interim, but he knows what's happened in the interim. So that's what I keep coming back to the same point, is that Yosef would love to believe that as the brothers walk in, they look at him in his royal clothing, say, voila, it's Yosef, look at that. Yosef really is king. But they can look Yosef in the face, and what happens? They bow down to him, not realizing that the prophecy is coming true, and they just then, okay, move on. And the problem over here is their silence. That's why I'm saying that if you read the verse over there, it's the silence. So when it says Vayitnaker Yosef Aleim, so again, there's two possibilities. One is that this was Yosef's plan the whole time. They're going to come in, I'm going to make myself distant from them. Or what I'm suggesting now is that Yosef distanced himself from them as a response to their lack of response. Said that's what I'm suggesting now. And by the way, let's admit something. Yosef, in his position of power, can do anything he wants to them. If he wants to take revenge, he can take revenge. He wants to kill them, he can kill them. He wants to put them in prison, he can put them in prison. He can play with them as much as he wants, as little one. That's also very, very clear. Which leads me back to asking this question, okay, what is his larger plan over here? And he's had a lot of time to think about this, and I know I'm repeating myself, but it's not that suddenly one day his brothers show up, oh my God, what am I going to do? My brothers are here, you know? I don't know what to wear, I don't know what to feed them and what to give and whatever. No. Yosef has known about this for the longest time. He's known about this moment since he's 17 years old, since he had the first dream. It was confirmed for him when he stood in front of Paro. He's had 9 years to think about this, and now they walk in, they bow down, and nothing. Okay, that's my point. My point is, it is the lack of response on the part of the brothers which starts the whole issue. Continue. Do you want all the question of the Ramban? Yes, no? Goes back to Yosef's frame of mind and Yosef's plan and what he wants to accomplish. The Ramban, you know the whole debate or argument or discussion whether we say Tanakh begova inayim, lo begova inayim. Yes, you know all these terms. You know what any of this means or nothing. Should I speak English? Yes? You can't have no response. Either yes or no.
No.
So, one of the big fights which exists today in Israel among the community, the tzibur, which is dati leumi, we would think, okay, a kipas ruga is a kipas ruga, but no. The major fight between them, which focuses on this one point, whether we look at the characters in Tanakh, migova einayim, which basically means we look at them as basically regular human beings who act in regular ways, or do we look at them as some kind of titan, the spiritual heroes that you need to look up, right? You need to look up to them. So is it migova einayim, or do you look up to them as heroes? As much as this is a modern-day question, there are times in the Gemara, there are times in the Midrash, there are times among the Rishonim and the Achronim who certainly look at them as regular human beings. I'm not saying everybody, but there are certainly those who do. Of course, here's the problem, just to make it a little bit more complex. On the one hand, if I look at our spiritual heroes as regular people, then it means I'm missing spiritual heroes. On the other hand, we live in a time of postmodernism. It's always a good phrase to use. But what does this have to do with postmodernism? Because postmodernism is full of deconstructionalism. The things that people who we used to look at as being heroes, now we take them apart and say they really weren't all that good. So when people do this with biblical heroes, taking them apart and showing why they're really actually really bad people, so then really what are we left with, especially in Tanakh? There's room to attack Avram and Sarah and you can go on, and certainly Rivka and Yitzchak, and right, and I can give you examples of all kinds of mepharshim will go and do this. So again, at the end of the day, so what are we left with? The Ramban asks a question where he is not the first and not the only one to ask it. And he has a particular agenda that he goes with. And this is certainly, if you were to ask me, dealing with Yosef as a regular person. But it actually caused in the 1970s a major, major back and forth, late 70s, a major back and forth between Rav Yoel ben Nun and Rav Meidan, regarding understanding Yosef's story. And what Rav Yoel ben Nun says is so compelling and so strong that people actually fall for it. And even though it's really, I'll get to it, it's really interesting but difficult. But it's all based upon the question that the Ramban asks, so I won't build it up anymore. Look at the Ramban in source number 4. Actually, we need to read one more pasuk, right? We're by Pasuk Chet. Let's read Pasuk Chet again. Vayakir Yosef et achav v'him lo ikiru, vayiskor Yosef et achalamot asher chalam lahem. Yosef remembers the dreams, vayomar l'meraglim atem, v'rot et ervat ha'aretz batem. He says, you guys are spies and you came to see the underbelly of the land. Let's look at the Ramban now. Source 4. Vayiskor Yosef et achalamot asher chalam lahem. Alehem. What does it mean, lahem? The dreams that he dreamed about them. V'yadashinet kaimu, and Yosef knew that the dreams would come true. Why? Sherei hishtachavulo. They already bowed down to him. Lashon Rashi. Lefi dati shadav behefech. Ramban says, no, as far as I'm concerned, it's the opposite. Ki yomar katuv ki birot Yosef et achav mishtachavim lo, zochar, and I put an emphasis here, kol hachalamot. When he sees them bowing down, he remembered all the dreams. Asher chalam lehem v'yadashelon etkayim echad mehim bepamazot. He said that the dream did not come true yet. Why did the first dream not come true? Because the first dream came. First dream says that all of his brothers, so there's one more brother who has not bowed down to him, that's Binyamin. So it's close, But according to the Ramban, it's not there yet. Ki yodei b'pitronam ki kol echad yishtachavu la b'tchila menachalom rishon. All of his brothers are supposed to bow down to him. V'nei anachnu malim alumim ki anachnu yirmoz l'kol echad echadasar. Means all of them. By the way, you can argue with the Ramban right now and say, no, anachnu means just those brothers. It doesn't mean Binyamin. I mean, his point is not as strong as he perhaps thinks it is. Upam shenit yishtachavu lo Hashem asher reich v'chadasar kochavim menachalom asheni. The second time, indeed, it does say that the sun and the moon and 11. There it gives a number. And because Binyamin wasn't with him, so the Ramban here is claiming that everything that Yosef is going to do here and all of his motivation is to make the dream come true. That's what he's trying to do. By the way, he didn't ask a question yet. The Alkain, therefore, lo ritza lagid lehem ani Yosef achichem. And therefore, he didn't want to say to them, I'm Yosef, I'm your brother. Lemor and say to them, Maharu ba'alu el avi, v'yishlacha agalot kasher samim pamashinit. And therefore, Yosef doesn't behave here like he eventually behaves when he does reveal himself to be Yosef, and he tells them to go and to bring their father, sends the agalot and so on, which means he's essentially asking, what is Yosef's strategy now compared to whose eventual strategy? Why is Yosef now acting the way that he acts when the next time, let's put it this way, it all goes back to Vayit Naker, he makes himself as a stranger to them. Why later on does he embrace them, and I'm Yosef, and you know, how's my father, and send food, and I'll take care of you all, and so on. And here we have basically the rest of Parshat Miketz, and the first part of Parshat Vayigash, Vayit Naker, that Yosef is really difficult with them. So now, I gave one approach to why this would be, because of their lack of understanding. The Ramban, though, has again, one thing on his mind, and that he's going to keep on coming back to, the dreams have to come true. Yosef is motivated by the dreams. Yeah.
Vayit Naker translates into he made himself not recognized by them.
Right, Vayit Naker, he made himself to be strange to them. Therefore, Vayit Naker, and he spoke very harshly. Liber Kashot. So the Ramban says, because the dream hasn't come through, right? V'alkein lo ritza lagid lehem ani Yosef achichem, v'limar ma'aru v'alu el avi. His father would have come immediately. He says, you know, without any question. And after the first dream came true, then Yosef wanted to try to work to make the second come true. And here he makes this his main evidence for this, which again we're going to turn into a question. Ulule Cain, had this not been the case, you need to ask something for me. Ulule Cain, if this were not the case, Hoya Yosef Chote Chet Gadol. Yosef would be guilty of a terrible sin. Letzar et David, to cause his father all of this pain. Ulamidu Yomim Rabim Bishkol, Ve'evil, Al Shimon Va'alav. For let his father believe, and let his father mourn and be concerned about Shimon about himself. I love that line. And even if his intention was to get a little bit of revenge against his brothers. Yes, you like that? By the way.
I was
trying to get revenge. Yosef. The Ramban writes, and even if his intention was to cause his brothers a little bit of pain. This, by the way, is a good example of Tanakh Begova Inayim, because it makes Yosef, okay, he goes, it's understandable, you want to get a little bit of revenge from your brothers. Ech lo yachmol al seivat aviv. It's also a great turn of phrase. How can he not feel bad for his father's white hair? Which means make his father worry and turn his hair white. Aval et hakol asa yafeh biito l'kayem hachalomot ki yadashit kemu be'emet. Yosef's entire motivation here was to make the dreams come true, because he knew that the dreams are going to come true. Yeah? Okay, we're in the middle. Go.
How does he know that the dreams are more important than honoring his father?
Stop. That's obvious, a question you can ask. Very good. V'chein ani omer, shekol aninim eila, hayu b'yosef b'chachmato b'pitaron hachalamot. The Ramban's contention is that everything that Yosef does is motivated by the dreams and his understanding of the dreams. Ki yesh l'tzmoa. Otherwise, here's the question. Otherwise, you can ask an unbelievable question. Okay, you ready? This is it. This is what got everybody talking. This Ramban. Ki yesh l'tzmoa. Otherwise, you can ask. Acha sha'amad Yosef in Mitzrayim yamim rabim, That once Yosef was in Egypt for a while, and he became a significant person in the house of one of the leading people in Egypt. By the way, what's he talking about? He's talking back in Potiphar's house. Eich lo shalach ktav echad la'aviv ulodiu ulenachamo. How is it that Yosef never sent a letter to his father saying, Dad, I'm alive, I'm well, everything is okay, and tried to relieve his father from all of his father's angst and worry and mourning and crying and so on? The Ramban continues, and you know he lived over here in Israel. Ki Mitzrayim karov l'chevron ki shisha yamim. From Egypt to Chevron was a six days worth of travel. Ve'ilu hoya malach shana, and even had the travel taken an entire year, it would have been worthwhile out of honor for his father, which means the Rabbi knows about honoring, but and his father would have paid any money to get him out. Again, this is still Potiphar's house. He would have got him out. Which means he's basically saying that the moment that Yosef was in charge of Potiphar's house, he had a certain leeway to do some things. He could have gotten a letter out to his father, a message to his father, that he's okay. Rather, Yosef saw that all of the bowing down, both of his brothers and his father and all their descendants, that couldn't happen in the land of Israel. Certainly, once Yosef heard the dream of Paro, and now he realizes, so the Ramban agrees with what I said before, or the other way around, that I agree with the Ramban, that Yosef knew from the moment he heard Paro's dream that everybody would be coming down at some point to be getting food. He knew his brothers were on the way. So what's the Ramban's question? And you all realize this is very disturbing. What's his question? His question is, why does Yosef never contact his father? That's the question. Why does Yosef never send a letter, Dear Dad, in Egypt, things are great, you know, send a postcard, having a great time. The question begins, as far as the Ramban is concerned, when already he's in charge of Potiphar's house. But the question gets escalated once he's in charge of all of Egypt. Which is, as far as he's concerned, he could have, I mean, even back almost immediately, Yosef could have, before he ends up in prison, he could have sent some kind of a message. But eventually, when he becomes the second most powerful man in Egypt and perhaps the Middle East, then he certainly could have sent some kind of message. Why doesn't he do it? That's the Ramban's question. And what's his answer? And his answer is an answer, am I correct in assuming that all of you find very disturbing? Or no? What's the Ramban's answer? The Ramban's answer is, because the dreams must come true. Yeah.
I don't really understand the nature of prophecy through dreams, but can't you argue that if he knows it's going to happen, it doesn't matter what he does, it'll still fulfill itself? Similar to the blessings that Yaakov received from Yitzhak, can't you argue, like when Yitzhak said that he's going to have wealth and power in the future, why does he fear for his life if he knows that, like either it's going to happen anyway, or right. If not, it's what he makes of it, and if it's what he makes of it, why call it a blessing or, right. Or a prophecy?
I like your question, and the Ramban obviously doesn't. I like it. I mean, I agree. But the Ramban is saying, no, the dreams must come true, and therefore Yosef has to work to make the dreams come true. Again, just to get a flavor of some who have disagreed with this, one is look at the Kli Yakar in source number 5. B'nei Binyan dibur kashot. Remember we said that he spoke very harshly to them. Yishtomem ko maskil mara Yosef ha-kacha letza'er et aviv achiv chinam. Anybody who reads this is going to be shocked to see how Yosef causes pain to his father and brothers for no reason. By the way, you can argue that his brother was for some reason, but why are his brothers in Egypt now? To bring food to his father. So if he's going to put his brothers in prison, then who's not going to get food? His father. And if Shimon is put in prison, doesn't go back with the man, who's going to be mourning for him? His father. And if he asks them to send Binyamin, who's going to be mourning? His father. Which means, ultimately, as much as you want to keep on saying that Yosef is doing the whole this to his brothers, his father's the one who's going to be suffering, you know, collateral damage from this. So he says, why is he doing all this to his father? Chinam, for no reason. Umasha piresh Ramban, shesak kol ze kedei shremu achalamot. And that which the Ramban wrote, that he's doing all this because the dreams should come true. Im yirtza Hashem bikiyumam. You wrote these words? If God wants the dreams to come true, Yosef ma pa'al. If God wants the dreams to come true, they'll come true, which means, what does that have to do with me? Which really, if I'll take your words and put more words in your mouth, what's your name?
Siona.
Siona is, again, absolutely correct in what she said, but now, does he make you feel better? Does the Kli Yakar say the exact same thing? But he's saying, man's job in this world is to act in an ethical, decent way. Decency includes being nice to your parents. Decency includes not causing your father to worry. Decency includes giving your father food. Decency does not include arresting your brothers, which is just going to end up bothering your father. And to say that I need to make the dreams come true, he said, what are you talking about? Dreams are God's problem, right? Prophecy even, if you want, is God's problem. But dreams are God's problem. It's not his problem. Venirli bezesh masha lo gilala aviva dain ki hu chai lefi shechashav im HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo gilalo im ken rotza HaKadosh Baruch Hu betzaro kof bet shana mida kenegin mida ve'ech milahu masha kisa HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's something very strange. He says, well, Yosef was a prophet. Yosef doesn't know about this, so apparently, sorry, Yaakov was a prophet. Yaakov didn't know that Yosef was alive, so apparently God didn't want him to know it. You know what this reminds me of? Two things. One is, in last week, it says, Vayefkoto Aviv, that his father cried for him. Remember what that was? Yaakov mourned because Yosef was gone. This is his father cried. Rashi there says, who's his father? His father's Yitzchak. The Yitzchak was still alive. Rashi also says, hold it, why doesn't Yitzchak tell Yaakov that Yosef is still alive? He says, that Yitzchak saw me, Ruach HaKodesh, Yaakov is alive. He says, okay, if God didn't give him that prophecy, apparently he's not to know it. You know what's really interesting? Because we always ask, when Rivka received the prophecy, why didn't she tell Yitzchak? Why? Because that's exactly what Rashi's saying. Apparently, she feels he's a prophet. If he doesn't know about it, God doesn't want him to know it. Now you see Yitzchak behaving the exact same way, according to Rashi, which I think is at least interesting. So as much as we like the first part of the Kli Yakar, then he goes on to say, okay, Yosef probably figured that his father needs to get punished for him not being with his father for 22 years. By the way, you realize the vicious cycle here?
So he's punishing his...
You realize the vicious cycle over here? Exactly. He's saying, oh, my father deserves to be punished because he left his father's house for 22 years, so therefore I need to punish him. Hold it. You need to punish him? What's then the next step going to be? Okay, so now you're going to have to get punished again. And who are you? Who are you? Who are you to punish him? So it's very sad. I'm going to read the words again. That God wanted him not to know. How can he reveal that which God did not want to reveal to him? So as much as we like the beginning of the Kli Yakar, he stalled. If you look at the Balei HaTosfot, this is the Rosh Mishantz in source number 6, V'tiret Rabbeinu Shimshon, She'imo yasholeach la'aviv kol devrim miyad, kol echav hayaborchim zem mikan mipnei abusha. Avolacha ma'at ma'at bedverim v'oshivam sholeit b'ishu ulutova nitkaven. So what does the Rosh say? He says that, again, say it's the same problem as the Ramban. Now you realize the Ramban's not the only one who asked this. He goes, why doesn't Yosef ever contact his father? He says, halt it a second. What do you say in the letter? Oh yeah, by the way, your other sons, they sold me. He says, the kids, they would have been humiliated. Rav Shim Shufal Hirsch says almost the same thing in Source 7. And by the way, it's worthwhile to look in context of his whole comment over here. There's a small part of it. Im ein ta'ut b'yadeinu, or ishikulim elahim she'iniyot Yosef, because Yosef was motivated this. Ma betza li Yaakov l'schut v'ben echad u'lishikel tachtav asara. What sense does it make for Yaakov to regain one son if he's going to lose 10 in the process? Which means for Yosef to reach out to his father necessarily means, at least in the minds we've seen of a couple of commentaries, necessarily means that in the process He loses the other sons because Yaakov comes to the realization what happened. Which, by the way, is a really good question. Does Yaakov ever know about Mechirat Yosef? Does he ever figure out what happened? Was he ever told what happened? There's no evidence whatsoever.
Probably senses it. He probably knows.
There's no evidence. I mean, it just as easy could have been that Yosef traveled 5 miles, got kidnapped, lo aleinu, b'tzomet agush, and ended up being, right, that's the road that he took up, 60. That's the road he would go from Hebron to go up, and gets kidnapped there and gets taken back down towards Gaza and through a tunnel off into Egypt. Just as easy could have happened. Yaakov has no idea what happened. The only evidence in the Chumash, which may be a lie, is when the brothers say, to him, right when they come back, and even before, after they bury Yaakov, the brother said, our father commanded that you be nice to us despite what we did to you. So the question is, are they telling the truth or not? It's the only time that we see the brothers claiming that Yaakov knows about it and said that you shouldn't take any more revenge. And then Yosef breaks down and cries once again and says, I can't believe you're accusing me of this, and so on, and so on and so forth. But aside from that pasuk, there's no evidence one way or the other if Yaakov ever knows. Yeah. Okay, good. That then really is the direction that Rav Yehuda ben Nun goes. Rav Yehuda ben Nun said, hold it a second. We keep asking the question, with all these commentaries, why is it that that Yosef never writes to Yaakov, that Yosef never reaches out to Yaakov and says, Dad, I'm fine, whatever. So Yehuda ben Nun suggested the question should be the other way around. Why is it that Yaakov never goes looking for Yosef? Why is it that Yaakov never, takes the initiative? So, of course, we know the answer to that. What's the answer? That Yaakov thinks Yosef is dead. Yaakov was presented with the evidence of the coat full of blood dipped in the goat. But does Yosef know what Yaakov was presented with? So he then went and suggested the following, that Yosef comes to this terrible realization. And his realization, by the way, it's not a true realization, but just because you have a realization doesn't mean that it's true. The terrible realization that Yosef has is that Yaakov was in on it.
So when does he come to the realization?
Maybe as he's sitting in the pit and screaming and saying, playing the whole thing through in his head. Hold it a second. My brothers hate me. My brothers hate the fact that I give reports to them. My father sends me to bring your report. He sends me to them.
That it's a conspiracy.
That's what Yehuda ben Nun suggests, that Yosef thinks it's a conspiracy and Yosef thinks his father is in on it. And look, his father never comes looking for him. Again, does Yosef know that his father thinks that he's dead? Now, if you go through the whole narrative from this point onward and you look at all the words that Yosef says to the brothers and all the words that the brothers say to Yosef, it's very interesting because, I mean, even look over here. When they say we're 12 sons of one man, look at Pasuk Yud Gimel, back in the first source. Perek Membet Yud Gimel. Vayomru, shnei mas avadecha avadim anachnu, b'nei ish achad, b'eretz kanan. V'nei hakatonet avino yom, b'chad inenu. We're 12 sons of one man, the youngest with his father, and what do they say about the 12th son? Yosef, b'chad. What's the word they use? Inenu. What does inenu mean? It's a very interesting word. But what does inenu mean?
Not
here. He's not here.
Why do they bring him up?
That itself is a great question, but hold on to that. That's a great question. But one second. This is the first time that they're discussing this, and the brother's narrative, the brother's story is about Yosef, inenu. What is... Translate Einenu into English for me.
Wait, and from this, Yosef knows that his...
Translate the word Einenu.
No longer.
He's no longer with us. Now, what does no longer with us mean?
Dead.
One second. Does it mean that it's dead, or does it mean that he's no longer a part of the family? Right, so they leave it in a very powerful way. By the way, Yosef, when he responds, he could have responded, okay, go find him and bring him to me. He also could have done that, but what does he say? Okay, so bring the younger brother to me as well. But I'm just saying is that they say enenu. And throughout the entire discussion over here, it's never mentioned that Yaakov thinks Yosef is dead. When is it mentioned for the first time? In next week's parsha, Vayigash. When Yehuda is in the midst of his soliloquy, and he goes through the whole story again, he told us to do this, and we did this, and we did what you said, and we asked, and so on. And then he says, my father had two sons from this wife. This is in Perek Mem Daled. Pasuk of Zion. Listen to the way that Yehuda says it now. Vayomer avdecha avi eleinu. This is what my father said to me. Atem yadatem. You knew. Kishnayim yoldali ishti. This wife, Rachel, had two children. V'yetzei echad mi'iti, and one of them left, v'omar af taraf taraf. And Yaakov said, and I believe he was ripped into pieces. V'lo re'iti v'adhena, and I have never seen him again. That's the first time that Yehuda says over what Yaakov thinks about Yosef. And right after this, what does he say? He says, I'm Yosef. Okay, I'm Yosef, which means that was really the evidence of Yehuda ben Nun, is that at this point he says, no. So therefore he figures that, again, what would the logic be? Going into Yosef's mind a little bit more, what would the logic be? That Yosef has made a lot of trouble. The whole family, everybody gets together. The only one who makes trouble is Yosef. What's the minhug? What's the custom in the family when you have a son who doesn't get along? What happens when Yishmael doesn't get along with Yitzhak? You send them away. What happens when Esav and Yaakov don't get along? Well, they end up sending them both away. But Esav gets sent away. Esav leaves the land of Israel. Yaakov comes back, Esav leaves. So Yosef is looking at this and saying, okay, my father has decided to get rid of me, and therefore Yaakov's involved in it. And that's his solution to it. Do you like this or you don't like it? I hope I didn't do too good of a job convincing of it. It's one of these things which is, Rav Breuer used to say, that we say, Shema, you have Emet v'Yatziv, right? And then you have V'tov v'Yafeh HaDavar Hazeh. That between Emet v'Yatziv, V'tov v'Yafeh, there's a long, I think there's a 14 or 15 words. This is Tov v'Yafeh. It's Tov v'Yafeh because it's very nice, it's very elegant, it's very pretty. But whether it's Emet v'Yatziv is a whole other story.
Like, right when he was in the pit, like last week, he said that he didn't, like, cry or say anything or ask
the phrase. I said that?
No,
I'm not. First of all, if I said it last week, I'm not responsible to what I said. Secondly, I don't think I said it. But
or like that he didn't, or maybe that they didn't care.
They were sitting and eating.
Yeah, they were sitting and eating. Yeah, they were indifferent. Quite the opposite. It says that he was screaming.
Oh, he was?
Well, it doesn't say it there. It says it over here.
Okay,
it says it over here when Yosef picks on the brothers right after this whole bowing down and they don't notice and then he starts to get tough on them. Vayan Ruvain Otam Lemor. Hello, Marti Alechem. Sorry. The pasuk before that. Vayomur Ish Elachiv, which is the same phrase which was used by the Mechira. They said, let's kill him, right? Vayomur Ish Elachiv, Aval Ashemim Anachna, but we're guilty. Alachinu, for our brother. Asher Inu Tzerat Nafsho. We saw the pain that he was enduring. Behit Chananu Aleinu, when he begged us. Velo Shamanu, we ignored him. It makes it sound alkin, right? Alkin barlein hotzerahazot, and that's why all these terrible things are happening to us. That's why I suggested that Yosef really does say something because he's screaming. I mean, they admit that he was screaming; they ignored him. Okay, so did I do too good of a job of presenting Rav Ben Nun's suggestion? Yeah.
Considering that when he was thrown into the pit, he knew that he was his father's favorite child, and that his brothers hated him, it seems like a jump to. Just seeing that the father was in on it, today's, as opposed to the brothers just being the ones.
Today's your day. I agree with you 100%. It's out of character for Yosef. You know, again, let's go back. Look how powerful of a character he is. He's strong in every single situation, but now you're saying that Yosef, still at the age of 39,
he's 39 now.
Okay. He was 17. And he's been away for 22 years. It says he was 30 years old when he stood in front of Paro. And another 9 years since then. Seven good years, two bad years. And he's 39 years old now. And you tell me that Yosef is still there saying, well, does my father love me? Does he care about me? Or whatever. It's just so out of character. This is not even a question in my mind in terms of Begove Naim, Lo Begove Naim. What troubles me is that this is not Yosef. So you can argue with me because someone else will say, no, it is Yosef. That's exactly the point. It's not Yosef. It just doesn't fit into character of the Yosef, which I think that we recognize. So therefore, we do have a problem. The problem is the Ramban's question is, in my mind, a lot better than his answer. What's his question? And now we see the question was echoed already. It was echoed by the Kli Yakar, it was echoed by Tosfot Shantz, Rashmi Shantz, it was echoed by Hirsch, and a lot of people over the years have echoed the same kind of question. Why was that Yosef never really reached out to his father and let him know that he was okay? And that I think really is a fair point, and it's one that you almost can't get through this parsha without really at some point asking you. That's the larger question. Then once you ask that question, then all the smaller points come up, and why does he do this and not this, and why does he treat them like this, and why does he say this? And I mean, which means the whole, as I said, there's a whole other strategy which is going on over here, which all has to be considered. But that's the larger question over here in terms of, what I think we can call the macro. I'll tell you what it is. Reveal Ben Nun turns Yosef into a teenager. You could say, yeah, that's fair. But, you know, teenagers today are very different from teenagers 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago. I mean, there were people who lived 500 years ago when they were 17 years old, already had 4 kids. Right? That's... Life was very different in those days. Actually, the teenage years, sociologically, were really created by child labor laws in Western countries. There are laws which were passed in most Western countries against child labor that you can't work more than X amount of hours a week until you turn the age 18. So that then took away what was virtual slavery for children in many, many cultures. Right? Once you're working age, you go and work. Again, you can, I don't know, you're all too young, so it's probably not even your grandparents. It could be still your great-grandparents, that they had education till fifth grade, sixth grade, if they were lucky, and then basically were sent out to work and do whatever you could in order to bring home food.
But when there was the whole psychology, really when it first started coming into play, they discovered that teenagers were different hormonally from children and adults, and that their emotions were different. Meaning it was a whole other stage of life that they now discovered. Adolescence wasn't really considered until then.
Right, but it's not just that. Adolescence also didn't exist. You're right in terms of hormones, but and even in terms of brain development.
No, but that's what I'm saying, is that what they came to realize is that it does exist, it always existed. People didn't know it existed, so they assume after childhood there's adulthood, there's no in-between.
Right.
And therefore, if you're acting like a baby... grow up because technically you're an adult.
Right, right. But nonetheless, this is not a situation which is black and white. And what I would say is that I agree with you in terms of hormones and in terms of brain development. The brain doesn't really develop until the age of 19 or something like that. Again, physically, there is changes within the development. That nonetheless, for thousands of years, as you said, you had child and adult. And teenagers, again, there's more I want to add to this. Teenagers become somebody who may be physiologically mature, but emotionally immature. And that's where the combinations come in, again, with the hormones and the rest of it. But what's interesting is that the trappings of teenagehood have been growing every single decade since the beginning of the 20th century, which means it used to be that when you were 30 years old, now you're finally mature, but that's not the case anymore. No offense, by the way, to anybody here who's under than that. But you look at behavior of people who today are in their mid-20s, 30s and mid-30s, they're, I'm not sure what I want to do yet, and I'm still finding myself, whatever, which means you have more and more people doing that who are basically acting on an emotional level like they're teenagers, and society allows them to do it, while that just didn't exist even 50 years ago.
Well, I know that this is a digression, but I read a book that was written in the late 17th, early 18th century, mm-hmm. way, way before any of this became a thing, mm-hmm. and I had no idea anything, I didn't know anything about the author, and as I'm reading it, I'm like, this sounds like it's written by this angsty teenager. He's so cynical, he hates everyone. He's complaining about this. He doesn't understand basic concepts about life and society, and he's just angry at everyone and upset at the smallest thing. And when I got to the end of the book, I flipped to the beginning and I found out that the guy was 18 years old when he wrote the book.
Right. Now, the only question is, did he ever mature?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to say that's the only question. If 10 years later he was better or not. Okay, point taken. But nonetheless, the way that Yolbenon is reading Yosef, because again, it's not just when he's 17. It's now when he's 39 that Yosef is still lacks confidence and he doesn't know his father loves him. Stop. You can't say that. Yosef knows his father loves him exactly. You said it before. Yosef is loved more loved than all the other kids. Yosef is treated in a different way. So why is it that Yosef is convinced that his father isn't involved in it? I find it, again, I can't disprove what he's saying. I just find it doesn't ring true as much as I can put it like that. Look at the end of the Kli Yakar, source number 5. Uma shetzi'er et achiv, asa kol ze l'mareik avonam b'ma shemachru acheihem, v'gadol avonom minso. By the way, it's the second time within that same paragraph he's talking about midah k'neged midah. His father needs it because his father needs this healing because he is away from his father for all these years. The brothers need healing because of the way they treated Yosef. So therefore, he's claiming that Yosef's motivation over here is not necessarily revenge. Remember the Ramban said a little revenge is okay? He's saying it's not revenge as much as what his brothers... What his motivation is one of rehabilitation of his brothers.
Right, but rehabilitating them from what?
Okay. So, let's just say from what they did.
Okay.
Let's go back and read the first source again, because I want to be a little bit more careful now. Because over here we're going to see a situation where simply the dialogue doesn't work. Or it doesn't seem to make sense, at least at first glance. You all ready? Back in source number 1, from the beginning. V'yosef hu ha-shalit al ha'aretz u'mashbir l'chol am ha'aretz v'yavo achi Yosef yishtach v'lo ha'im ha'aretza. Right, Yosef is in charge of everything. His brothers come, bow down. So again, I'm pointing out that I think is what's troubling, is that they don't respond. V'yayir Yosef et achav v'yakirem v'inakel aleihem v'divaritam kashot. Yosef recognize them. He acts as a stranger to them. He speaks to them very differently. And he says, where have you come from? He said, we came from the land of Canaan to get food. By the way, at that point, just in case he wasn't sure if it's them, now he knows that it's them. Right? Just in case he wasn't sure, but I'm not convinced he didn't know. So again, it could be because once they said where they're from, and they don't recognize him at all, which again is a problem. He remembers the dreams that he dreamed. So now, how is that all connected? So we saw what the Ramban did with that. The Ramban now turns that into the major motivation all the way through. Vayomer aleihem, and he says to them, "Meraglim atem, lerot et erva ta'aretz batem." He says to them, "You're spies. You came to find." How would you translate erva ta'aretz? There's actually two possibilities. Erva ta'aretz.
One is naked.
Well, right. So the nakedness of the land can mean one of two things. One, it could be the vulnerability of the land, which means in which place, spies are looking to conquer the land, you're looking for where the land is vulnerable. What's the other possibility of erva ta'aretz? Another possibility would be that you've come to the red light district of the town, of the city. By the way, that doesn't make so much sense. Meraglim le'erva ta'aretz. Again, what does erva has to do with nakedness? That's what I would say. You came to the seedy parts of town. You came looking in the places that respectable people should not be going. Vayomru elav, pasuk yud, lo, adoni, vavadecha bo lishbar ochel. We didn't go to that. We're here to get food. No, we're all part of one family. We're straightforward. We're honest. We're not spies. He goes, no. You came to look in the Erevat Aretz. ויאמרו 12 עבדיך אחים אנחנו, בני איש אחד, בארץ כנען, בני קטון תבינו יום ואחד איננו. But by the way, what does Yosef want from them? Yosef says, you're spies. They said, we're not spies. He goes, you are spies. So what does he want? Brother, it's very, very simple. Very simple, except I don't know if anybody ever said it. It's very, very simple what he wants. He says they're spies, and they say we're not spies. He goes, you are spies. What does he want them to say?
That they're here to look for him.
What does he want to say? He says, yes, we are spies. That's what he wants them to say. We're spies.
We're spying for our
boat. Right. How do I know that that's what he wants to get out of them? I'll prove it in a second. But how do I know that that's what he wants to get out of them? Because, again, go back to one stage. First stage is, they come in, they bow down to him. What does he want? He wants them all to say, Yosef, you really are king. The dreams came true. They can't see that Yosef is a respectable person. They can't see that Yosef really is in charge. They can't see that Yosef really is the person that he always thought he was. And he goes, okay, by the way, that's plan A. I want to be very careful. There's plan A, there's plan B, and there's plan C. Unfortunately, we're going to get to plan C. What's plan A? Plan A, you say, what has Yosef been waiting for? He's waiting for the brothers to come in and say, okay, you're Yosef. Okay, we accept and so on. Plan B. Plan B is Yosef now very quickly in his mind goes and he says, okay. He makes himself sound like a stranger. And he goes, where are you from? They're from Israel. Good. What are you doing here? And I'm going to go again. Don't argue with me again unless you have to. What's his fantasy now? That they're going to say that we're looking for something. By the way, I want to ask you a whole other question. This is an alternative, right, ending, different universe, different life. What would have happened if the brothers walk into Yosef right now, and Yosef says, you're looking for something, meraglim atem, and they say, what would have happened if they would have said, yes, many years ago, we got into a fight with our brother, right? Whatever. We thought our father loved him and whatever, and the whole thing, don't ask. But our brother ended up coming down to Egypt, and we are looking for him. We want to bring him back home. Right? How would the story have ended, right? If they would have said that to Yosef, we're looking for our brother. Or we'll take the words of Yosef, we're looking for our brother. What would Yosef's response have been at that point? This is plan number two. What would Yosef have said? Would Yosef have said, no, and you this and that? Again, you can't disprove it because I'm making up a whole scene that never happened. I believe 100% of the brothers would have said that we are looking for Yosef, that Yosef would have said, and Yosef. Ha'od avichai. Right. Then it would have, the whole thing would have ended right over here, which means plan A was for them to recognize the greatness of Yosef. Plan B was, he realizes now what they're thinking. They cannot imagine that Yosef really became king. Okay, that's okay. Which means they still don't know the dreams came true. They're not there. Again, this total opposite of what Ramban is saying. They don't believe the dreams come true. They can't believe it. Maybe they'll never believe it. So what does he say then? Okay, so what do you see Yosef as? So Yosef was a good-looking, right? He was a good-looking boy. He was sold off as a slave. Let's not be naive. What was slaves sold for in those days, with his kind of qualifications? They don't think he can do anything else. So he says to them, okay. So you've been looking in the red light district for something. He's bringing them right there. Fine. You don't think he could be a king. You think Yosef would have been a male prostitute? Said that. At Erevat Haaretz, you're spies. You're looking for something. So what do they say? No, we're not spies. What does he say? No, you are spies. Why does he keep saying you are spies?
He wants them to be spies.
He wants them to say, yeah, we're looking for Yosef. And by the way, if you think I'm... Just read the words and we'll do it again. He remembers the dreams, and they don't. That's exactly the point. He remembers the dreams that's really come true. They don't. But he goes, fine. You guys are spies. You're looking for something. They don't recognize it's Yosef. They don't recognize the dreams. They don't recognize anything. You're looking for Yosef. What do they say? No. We only came for food. Again, you have to go back in Yosef's mind when he's looking at this and saying, okay, after all these years, you're coming down to Egypt. You know Yosef was sent to Egypt. You can't recognize when he's standing in front of your face. So maybe at least you're looking for him. Like I said before, you have a long-lost brother. You're looking around for him, something. So what did they say? No. We're only looking for Yosef. By the way, there is a midrash that says the brothers came in through 12 different openings, 12 different gates or cities, whatever. They came through different ways, and each one went away. They were looking for him. So that midrash makes it all the more bittersweet, because if they really are looking for him, they can't admit that they're looking for him, so then we have miscommunication. But as I said, I don't see any evidence for that within the text itself. And when I bring midrashim, I try to do it ones that really do fit into the text. So Yossi says, again, know your spines. No, we're only looking for food. No, we're not spies. No, you've been looking. You're looking in the bad parts of the town. You're looking for somebody. The youngest one is with his father. So we already did that before. What does v'chad einenu mean?
No.
And one is. It's not with us. Look at Yosef's response. Pasuk Yudalet. Vayomer leim Yosef, who asher dibarti aleichem leimor meraglim atem. He's the one I'm referring to when I said that you're spies and you're looking for someone. One second. Is that black and white?
Yeah.
Who asher, he says, achad einenu, one isn't here. Pasuk Yudalet again. Vayomer leim Yosef, who asher dibarti aleichem leimor meraglim atem.
It's not who, he.
Ah, echad yodat.
That's...
So what my point is, that's exactly who regarding to what? Achad einenu, who asher marti lechem meraglim atem. Achad einenu, that's exactly what I'm talking about, that you're spies. Which is, Yosef is leading, right? You all see it? Yosef is leading them right there to say, no. And what do they respond? What's the next pasuk? You have it. They're silent. And then he says, "Bezot tibochenu, chei paro imtetsu mizeh, ki im bavo achichem akaton heina." He goes, "Okay, you're not going to get out of this so quickly. Go and bring your younger brother here now." What's the connection between the younger brother, Mama, with all this? So I want to say it again. I believe that Yosef had a very long time to think about it. Yosef's first plan is, the original plan is, his original plan is that they walk in, they recognize that it's Yosef, they realize that they're wrong, they apologize, they make up, and therefore they are able to recognize the error of their ways, and yesh po eizeshu unyan shel tshuva. They say, we're sorry. Why? Because they see it's Yosef. But what's the problem? The problem is they can't see it's him. But by the way, this is the definition of sinat chinam. They say, sinat chinam is mikhirat Yosef. What is sinat chinam? Sinat chinam is the inability of saying, you hate somebody so much, you can't even see why they're great. You hate somebody so much, you can't even see anything positive about them. Yosef could be standing in front of them, but as far as they're concerned, it's impossible. And by the way, don't you realize that this is such a strong question? As much as we ask about Yosef's behavior, why is it the brothers come to Egypt, hold it, who do we know that used to be, that was in Egypt? Yosef, okay? They come to Egypt, and there is this strange guy asking about where they're from, asking about their father, asking about their brother, right? Having this unnatural, bizarre interest in their family. Why is it they never figure out that it's Yosef? I figured it out. Every year when I read it, I keep asking the same question. Why do they know what's going on? Again, so maybe I read ahead, I know how it ends. Why is it they can never figure it out? And the answer is that for them, it's impossible that it's Yosef. So Yifshar, the bilti of Shari. It can't be Yosef. Why can't it be Yosef? Because Yosef is a low-life loser, imposter, delusions of grandeur. It's not even possible it's Yosef. It never occurs to them the possibility that this guy standing in front of them is Yosef. Okay, that's part of the tragedy. Yosef could be staring in front of them and they don't know that it's Yosef. So Yosef understands this. So Yosef says, okay, they have not accepted who Yosef is. They can't accept who Yosef is, so fine. You're going to the bad parts of the city. You're going to the other things. You've been looking for him there, at least. So, no, we're not looking for anything. All we want is food. So at that point, Yosef says, okay, so let's stop a second. Because again, what is the sin over here? The sin is not just the mechira. Because I want to look at this in a much broader sense. The sin is not just the sale. It's not just the mechira. It's that Am Yisrael is going to suffer through a division. We have the sons of Rachel and the sons of Leah. We have basically... or the sons of Rachel and everybody else. The rejection of Yosef is the rejection of Rachel, and therefore the rejection of a part of Am Yisrael. And Yosef is looking at this and saying, hold it, if you're going to reject part of Am Yisrael. So we have a problem right over here. So what's the best way to fix it? If they can accept that Yosef is really born to be king. And this, okay, there are two kings. There's Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. This is from Yehuda and this is from Yosef. That's okay, but they can't recognize the greatness of Yosef even when staring at them. That was plan A. So what's plan B? So at least be looking for him. You can't love him, at least look for him. At least look for him, try to bring him back to your father. At least try to bring the family together. Sefer Bereshit can't end with a division in Klal Yisrael. It can't end with there being something broken. So then what's plan C? Plan C is, okay, if you can't cause a reconciliation with a son of Rachel named Yosef, let's try a different son of Rachel named Binyamin, and let's see if you can at least, you know, show some kind of love and affection toward him. Because if you can't, look, it becomes very simple. What Yosef does in his whole plan, and as I said, I want to get to more detail next time, what Yosef does in his plan, he does all that he can to make them say, Maspik, enough of Binyamin, his brother wasn't okay, he's not okay, his mother wasn't okay, and walk away and wash their hands and this whole part of the family. If they do that, then we have Am Yisrael, which is fractured, broken, and that's a very bad way to end the book. What Yosef wants to get them to do is not to reject him, and to rally behind him. Is to go and rally behind him. What's at stake? What's at stake is I'll give you a little hint, which Chazal hint at. A remez. I'll give you a little. I'm gonna give you a little hint, which Chazal point at. When they finally get together, look at verse 17. V'yipol tzavarei Binyamin achiv v'yefku v'nim b'cha al tzavarav. That Yosef cries on Binyamin's shoulders and Binyamin cries on Yaakov on Yosef's shoulder. Rashi vayipol tzavarei Binyamin achiv vayefk al shnei mikdashim she'atidin liyot bechelik shel Binyamin v'sofu licharev uvamin bacha al tzavarav al mishkan shilo she'atid liyot bechelik shel Yosef v'sofu licharev. Why was he crying? They were crying about the what does the Beit HaMikdash have to do with this? At the end of the day, where is the Beit HaMikdash built? It's built in Chelek Binyamin. Why it's built in the Chelek Binyamin? Because Binyamin is the one who unifies all the brothers together. So the Beit HaMikdash symbolizes the unity. Who's the one who at the end of the day takes responsibility? It's Yehuda. So where's the Beit HaMikdash going to be built? Right at the point that Yehuda and Binyamin meet. That's where the Beit HaMikdash is going to be built one day, which means this later manifestation of the Beit HaMikdash is a manifestation of the Ahava or the Sinah. Why does the Beit HaMikdash get destroyed? Because of Sinat Chinam. So again, this is exactly the point. Where could the Beit HaMikdash been built? In Shiloh. Where's Shiloh? Which is in the chelik of Yosef. And Binyamin cries for that, which means the fact the brothers are going to reject Yosef is why Shiloh is not going to end up lasting, because it's not going to become a place of unity. It's going to become a place...
But Yosef is the person that unifies
them. But at the end, they don't unify over him. At the end, they never really truly accept him. Even after their father's dead, they cry and they say, okay, don't take revenge on us. They never trust him. That's part of the sadness over here. But as far as the test with Binyamin, that they do end up passing. Most of the Makarot that I'm going to skip, they all talk about one thing. And it's both in the Midrash and in the Zohar. They talk about the beauty of Yosef. I mean, Yosef is one of the very few male characters, maybe the only one in Chumash, who's described as, in terms of his looks as somebody who is...
Also David, no?
In Chumash. Oh. In Chumash, somebody who is attractive. It's also interesting where it's said. It's said in source number 8, exactly the point the Ramban asked the question. V'yazov kol asher lo biyad Yosef, v'lo yada ito mu'uma, ki malech masher hu ochel, v'yosef yofeima, toar v'yofeimareh. Yosef is very attractive, which is exactly the same description of his mother in verse 9. V'nelei rakot v'rachel hayta yifat toar v'yifat mariah. But Yosef so apparently looks like his mother. That was the point. That Yosef's in charge. That was the point he could have reached out. So now the question is, why doesn't he reach out? Or for that matter, why doesn't he send a letter? Why doesn't he try to do something? So I would say, again, I'm going the same direction of the Kli Yakar. Maybe I'll nuance it slightly differently. I think that Yosef feels it's important that the brothers really need to, not that he has to teach them a lesson, but they need the healing to take place. They need to do tshuva. They need for there to be unity in Klal Yisrael, and they don't realize that unity. So that's why I keep saying that there's three different places over here the unity could take place. The unity could be they realize the greatness of Yosef. Sad that they can't realize that, even though they're looking at him. So fine, at least realize that it's their brother Yosef. You're looking for somebody. No, we're not doing that either. So fine. And the unity ends up going on in plan number C. Although I do want to note that...
It's interesting because he's the only one who can't really affect his brothers, but he wants them to go through the tahlich by themselves because he knows maybe that he can't affect them.
Right, but. Right. I do want to suggest one thing. There's a very famous midrash. It's source number 14. It's a midrash in Eicha Rabba. It talks about during the time of the after Churban Bayit Rishon. It says, it's a very long midrash. It starts off by saying that God was crying, and then Avram is crying, and Yitzchak is crying, and Yaakov, and he calls them in, and he talks to them and says, you know, give some kind of argument, say something. And it says nobody has anything to say. They can't argue to save the Jews. Again, this is after the Korban. V'oto sha'a kavtza Rachel imenu lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. At that moment, Rachel jumps forward and says, V'amri bono sholam, Master of the Universe, galui lefanecha she Yaakov avdecha avani ava yitera, avad b'shvili la'aba sheva shanim. You know that Yaakov loved me, and he worked for my father for 7 years. U'kishishlima oton sheva shanim v'yigia zman niso'e leba'ali, and would come the moment to get married, ya'atza v'ilach lifeini leba'ali b'shvil achoti. My father decided to switch us. V'ukshah la'ya davar ad ma'od. Ki noda'a li'ya etza, v'odati leba'ali u'masarti lo siman, she says that she found out about Lavan's plan, so she makes arrangements with Yaakov in order to try to circumvent or to get by Lavan's plan. I calmed myself down. I controlled my desires. And I compassion for my sister. That she should not be humiliated. And I gave my sister all the signs that Yaakov would think it was Rachel. Not only that, Ella, this is just an unbelievable image. I crawled under the bed. And when Yaakov spoke to her, she was silent. So she said that during this whole switch, I was there, I was part of it, and I performed chesed for my sister. I didn't have jealousy. I wouldn't let her be humiliated. And then Rachel says, Uma ani shani basar v'dam afa ve'efer. What about me? That I'm made of flesh and blood. I'm made of dust. Lo kineti letzarashili. I was not jealous of this other woman, this competition. Lo tziti levusha ulcherpa. And I wouldn't let her be humiliated and embarrassed. Va'ata melech chay v'kayam. And you, King of the Universe, Rachman, and you're compassionate. Mipnei ma kineta lavodat kochavim she'in bo mamash. Why were you jealous of idolatry, which is, it has no meaning. I gave my husband to my sister, who's a real person. You're jealous of idolatry. V'higleita banai, and my children have been exiled. V'nergu b'cherev, and they were killed by the sword. V'suei ve'im b'am kirtzanam, and their enemies did to them as they wished. Miyad nitgalgalu rachamav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'amar b'shvileich Rachel, ani machzir et Yisrael l'mekoman. Because of you, Rachel, I'm going to bring them back. Which means the second Beit HaMikdash is built because of Rachel. Haduhu dichtiv, and that's what it means in Yirmiyahu, which describes the first Korban. Komar Hashem kol baramah nishma, nihi b'chit hamurim, Rachel mevakel b'nei. Me'enali nachem, Rachel's crying bitterly for her children. She refuses to be comforted. Al b'nei ke'enenu, because they're not here. By the way, the enenu is very interesting also. The enenu that we had there. Chad enenu, ke'enenu. Uktiv, and it further says, Ko amar Hashem, min'i kolech mibechi, v'naich midim'a, ki yesh schar lufulatech, v'ktiv, v'yesh tekva la'acharitech, na'um Hashem, v'shavu banim l'gvulam. That this Midrash is telling us, the reason that Am Yisrael is going to be brought back for the second Beit HaMikdash is all because of Rachel. So what I'm pointing out, this is really the beauty of Rachel. The beauty of Rachel is the ability of being so self-sacrificing in order for her sister not to be embarrassed. But so what I was thinking is that maybe this is the exact same thing, that Yosef is beautiful like his mother. Yosef looks like his mother. Zohar says he looks just like his mother. That Yosef is willing to sacrifice himself for all these years to be separated from his father. Again, not to send the letter. Because he knows his brothers have to do tshuva. If he, again, as we saw Rav Hirsch and others say, if he just sends a letter, his brothers are humiliated and all run away. So he has to find a way to reach out to them, for them to realize they made a mistake. The first opportunity is they walk in. He thinks they're going to accept that. They don't. The second opportunity, okay, you're looking for him. They're not even looking for him. He said, "Who else am I eating the Morag Limitan?" That's what I'm talking about. They said, "No, no, no. We just want food." So he says, "Okay, let's go to Plan C." And Plan C is Binyamin, and that's where the Beit HaMikdash is eventually built in the Chelek of Binyamin, because that represents the unity of Klal Yisrael. And that's what Yosef is trying to work for, is trying to get to this point of unity. The various details that he uses, so Beli Nedr, we'll see that next week.